Three or four weeks after the Mother's Day debacle, Dr. Bob looked at me one morning and said, "Bill, for a number of years, I have had to go down to Atlantic City to our medical convention. I haven't missed one in a long time. Don't you think I had better go?" Very frightened, Ann said, "Oh, no, no." But seeing that he had to face the music sometime, I replied, "Well, why don't you go? After all, we must learn to live in a world that's full of alcohol." And slowly Bob said, "I guess maybe you're right." So he went to the Atlantic City Medical Convention, and nothing was heard of him for several days. Then one morning his office nurse called up and said, "He is over here at my place. My husband and I picked him off the railroad station platform at about 4 a.m. Please come over and see what you can do." We got Bob back home and into bed, and right then we made an alarming discovery. He had to perform a certain operation that only he could do. The deadline was just 3 days away. He simply had to do the job himself. And here he was, shaking like a leaf. Could we get him sober in time? Ann and I took turns around the clock trying to taper the old boy off. Early on the morning of the operation, he was almost sober. I had slept in the room with him. Glancing across toward his bed, I saw that he was wide awake, but still shaking. I'll never forget the look he gave me as he said, "Bill, I'm going to go through with it." I thought he meant the operation. "No," he said, "I mean this thing we've been talking about." Ann and I drove him to the hospital at 9 o'clock. I handed him a bottle of beer to steady his nerves so he could hold the knife, and he went in. We returned to the house and sat down to wait. After what seemed an endless time, he phoned. All had gone well. But after that, he didn't come home for hours. Despite the awful strain, he had left the hospital, got into his car, and commenced to visit creditors and others he had harmed by his behavior. That was June 10th, 1935. To the time of his death, 15 years later, Dr. Bob never took another drink of alcohol. Next day, he said, "Bill, don't you think that working on other alcoholics is terribly important? We'd be much safer if we got active, wouldn't we?" I said, "Yes, that would be just the thing. But where can we find any alcoholics?" He said, "They always have a batch down at the Akron City Hospital. I'll call them up and see what they've got." Getting hold of a nurse friend of his on the receiving ward of the hospital, Dr. Bob explained that a man from New York had just found a new cure for alcoholism. We called it a cure in those days. But the nurse knew Dr. Bob of old. So she retorted, "Is that so, Dr. Bob? You don't mean to tell me you've tried it on yourself?" "Yes," he said, "I sure have." The new customer was in no shape to be seen. But 2 days later, Dr. Bob and I were looking into the face of the first man on the bed. It was old Bill D., AA number 3, whose story you can read in the second edition of the Big Book. Bill was still pretty glassy-eyed. When Dr. Bob and I gave him the medical bad news about the allergy and the obsession, old Bill showed a startled interest. But when we began to describe our spiritual approach, Bill shook his head and said, "No, I'm too far gone for that. I've always believed in God. I used to be a deacon in the church. But boys, I've been in and out of this place 6 times in the last 4 months. This time in DTs, I badly beat up one of the nurses. I know I can't even get home from here sober. I'm afraid to go out. No, it's too late for me. I still believe in God, all right, but I know mighty well that he doesn't believe in me anymore." "Well, Bill," we said, "can we come back and see you tomorrow?" "Yes," he replied. "You fellas really understand. Sure, I'd like to see you." So the next day we came back and found him talking to his wife, Henrietta. Bill pointed to us and said, These are the fellows I was telling you about. They are the ones that know. They understand what this thing is all about. Then Bill told us how, during the night, hope had dawned on him. If Bob and I could do it, he could do it. Maybe we could all do together what we could not do separately. 2 days later, Bill suddenly said, "Henrietta, fetch me my clothes. I'm going to get up and get out of here." Bill walked out of that hospital a free man, and he never took a drink again. The spark that was to flare into the first AA group had been struck. Dr. Bob and Bill D. and I went frantically to work with more of those alcoholic characters at the city hospital. We had a long string of failures. Notable among these had been Eddie. In fact, Dr. Bob and I had tackled him just before our first visit with Bill D. Every time Eddie got drunk, he wanted to jump off the Cleveland docks. Once, when angered, he had tried to emphasize a point by waving a knife at Ann and me. He finally did make the grade, and recently wrote me that he has been sober for 7 wonderful years. So Eddie, our first failure, so-called, is today a success. Then from another quarter, we turned up with a prize. I guess this was the beginning of AA's young people's department. This new one, Ernie, had been a terribly wild case, yet he caught on very quickly to become AA number 4. As I remember it, we straightened up only 2 more during that whole summer in Akron. By September, my proxy fight backers had got tired again. I had to go home to New York. Right here, I want to set on record the timeless gratitude that AAs will always have for Henrietta Seiberling, she who first brought Dr. Bob and me together. Of the 10 people to whom I had been directed by clergyman Walter Tunks, Henrietta was the only one who had understood enough and cared enough. And this had been only the beginning of her mission. During that first summer at Akron, she affectionately counseled many an alcoholic's family, just as Anne was doing. Despite the fact that she had no direct experience of alcoholism, Henrietta had a rare capacity for identification with us. Therefore, she was eagerly sought out for her great spiritual insight and the help she could give. What Alcoholics Anonymous owes to her will always be beyond anybody's reckoning. And Dr. Bob's debt and mine are the greatest of all. By the time I got home, I was endowed with a little more humility, a little more understanding, and considerably more experience. Very slowly, a group began to take shape in New York. Lois, not content with nursing me all those years, thought it would be wonderful if we filled the old family house in Clinton Street with alcoholics. Her mother had passed away, and her father, a doctor, had moved elsewhere. So why not? We thought we could feed our charges at low cost and pick up a lot of knowledge about alcoholism. As it turned out, we did not sober up a single one. But we did pick up a lot of knowledge. We used to have as many as 5 in the house at a time, and sometimes they would all be drunk at once. One day, we came home to find a drunk swinging a piece of 2x4 on another down in the cellar. I don't remember what their resentment was. On another occasion, we had been away for a week, leaving only one problem drinker alone in the house, and we came back to find him dead, a suicide. We continued our work on alcoholics, some of them in Sam Shoemaker's Oxford group, some at Calvary Mission, some at Charlietown's hospital, where good old Dr. Silkworth risked his reputation by letting us see them. Lois and I continued to find, however, that if we permitted alcoholics to become too dependent on us, they were apt to stay drunk. In that fall of 1935, a weekly meeting took shape in our Brooklyn parlor. In spite of much failure, a really solid group finally developed. There was first Henry P., and there was Fitz M., both out of town's hospital. Following them, more began to make real recoveries. Until the middle of 1937, we in New York had been working alongside the Oxford groups. But in the latter part of that year, we most reluctantly parted company with these great friends. Naturally enough, they did not think too highly of our objective, limited as it was to alcoholics. From our point of view, we felt very sure we couldn't do much about helping the Oxford groups to save the whole world, but we were becoming more certain every day that we might be able to sober up many alcoholics. The Oxford groupers had clearly shown us what to do, and just as importantly, we had also learned from them what not to do as far as alcoholics were concerned. We had found that certain of their ideas and attitudes simply could not be sold to alcoholics. For example, drinkers would not take pressure in any form, excepting from John Barleycorn himself. They always had to be led, not pushed. They would not stand for the rather aggressive evangelism of the Oxford groups, and they would not accept the principle of team guidance for their own personal lives. It was too authoritarian for them. In other respects, too, we found we had to make haste slowly. When first contacted, most alcoholics just wanted to find sobriety, nothing else. They clung to their other defects, letting go only little by little. They simply did not want to get too good too soon. The Oxford group's absolute concepts, absolute purity, absolute honesty, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love, were frequently too much for the drunks. These ideas had to be fed with teaspoons rather than by buckets. Besides, the Oxford group's absolutes were expressions peculiar to them. This was a terminology which might continue to identify us in the public mind with the Oxford groupers, even though we had completely withdrawn from their fellowship. There was yet another difficulty. Because of the stigma then attached to the condition, most alcoholics wanted to be anonymous. We were afraid also of developing erratic public characters who, through broken anonymity, might get drunk in public and so destroy confidence in us. The Oxford groups, on the contrary, depended very much upon the use of prominent names, something that was doubtless all right for them, but mighty hazardous for us. Our debt to them, nevertheless, was and is immense, and so the final breakaway was very painful. Out in Akron, wonderful friends continued to show up. In the forefront of these was T. Henry Williams and his wife, Clarice, Oxford groupers also. They and Henrietta had repeatedly tried to help Dr. Bob. On several occasions, they had gone far in discussing their own personal defects with him in order to get some kind of closer identification with him. This had impressed him a great deal and had doubtless made him far more ready to work with me when I showed up. I had met T. Henry at the time of the proxy fight, and as a result of the shake-up, he had lost a fine job. He was big-hearted enough, nevertheless, to let us alcoholics come to his house for meetings along with his Oxford group friends. I am afraid those early problem drinkers often gave the Williamses a bad time, ranging from jarring glimpses of life in the raw to cigarette burns on their carpets. But T. Henry and Clarice always treated us with great generosity and kindness, and none of us can ever forget the inspirational atmosphere of their home and their spiritual influence on that first frightened little group of Akron alcoholics, each wondering who might slip next. It was not until later, and well after the AA book was published, that our Akron members withdrew from the Oxford groups and finally from the home which had sheltered them so well. T. Henry and Clarice Williams will always be counted in the front rank of AA's pioneers. Gradually, the New York and Akron groups began to multiply. From New York, we began to reach out toward Philadelphia and Washington. In Akron, they began to have visitors from Cleveland, Clarence and Dorothy and Abby and all those grand folks. The AA ferment had begun to work and spread. In 1937, I went back to Wall Street for a brief stretch. In the fall of that year, another depression hit the U.S., and I was suddenly out of a job. I went west, where I tried Detroit and Cleveland for another position in the financial business. Nothing turned up, but this trip gave me a much-needed chance to visit Dr. Bob in Akron. It was on a November day in that year when Dr. Bob and I sat in his living room counting the noses of our recoveries. There had been failures galore, but now we could see some startling successes, too. A hardcore of very grim last-gasp cases had by then been sober a couple of years, an unheard-of development. There were 20 or more such people. All told, we figured that upwards of 40 alcoholics were staying bone dry. As we carefully rechecked this score, it suddenly burst upon us that a new light was shining into the dark world of the alcoholic. Despite the fact that Evie had slipped, a benign chain reaction, one alcoholic carrying the good news to the next, had started outward from Dr. Bob and me. Conceivably, it could one day circle the whole world. What a tremendous thing that realization was. At last we were sure. There would be no more flying totally blind. We actually wept for joy, and Bob and Ann and I bowed our heads in silent thanks. Then came a mighty sobering thought. This knowledge, this precious know-how, was still in the hands of too few of us. Must every alcoholic come to New York or Akron in order to get well? No, that would never do. That would be impossible. How then could we spread our message? Ruefully, we remembered that alcoholics, even when sober, are far from being grown-up people. All of us could still be terribly erratic characters. Would the forces that everywhere divide society finally invade and smash us up, just as they had invaded and destroyed the promising Washingtonian group movement among alcoholics a century before? How could we possibly hang together and cling to our new lifeline, this line whose strands were woven of medicine and of religion and of our own experience? Could we carry the message to the distant alcoholic? Could we grow rapidly and soundly? We saw that we had a grave responsibility. Fortunately, we found we had great faith, too. Faith that we could go farther, perhaps much farther. But I must confess that as we sat there that afternoon in Dr. Bob's living room, we could not see at all how these riddles might actually be answered. Yet tonight, only 18 years later, thousands of us in this vast auditorium can see and hear and touch one another. Bound in the unbreakable kinship of a common suffering and a common worldwide deliverance, we know at last that Alcoholics Anonymous is safe. Even this great gathering is only a token representation of us all, of AA's thousands of groups, of our 200,000 members in 70 U.S. possessions and foreign countries. This host, we think, is but the first fraction of multitudes still to come. Would that tonight Dr. Bob could stand here among us to voice all that we now feel so deeply. Indeed, we who know him well can almost see and hear him now. With us, we know that he is exclaiming, "What hath God wrought?" The 12 Traditions. 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a sincere desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA, as such, ought never to be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never to be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Unity, the second legacy. Today, we in AA are together, and we know we are going to stay together. We are at peace with each other and with the world around us. So many of our conflicts are resolved that our destiny seems secure. The problems of yesterday have produced the blessings of today. Ours is not the usual success story. Rather, it is a story of how, under God's grace, an unsuspected strength has arisen out of great weakness, of how, under threats of disunity and collapse, worldwide unity and brotherhood have been forged. In the course of this experience, we have evolved a set of traditional principles by which we live and work together and relate ourselves as a fellowship to the world around us. These principles are called the 12 Traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. They represent the distilled experience of our past, and we rely on them to carry us in unity through the challenges and dangers which the future may bring. It was not always so. In the early days, we saw that it was one thing for a few alcoholics to get well, but the problem of living and working together was something else. Therefore, it was into an uncharted future that we looked from the window of Dr. Bob's living room in 1937, when we first realized that alcoholics might be able to get well in large numbers. The world around us, the world of more normal people, was being torn apart. Could we recovered alcoholics hold together? Could we carry AA's message? Could we function as groups and as a whole? No one could say. Our friends, the psychiatrists, with some reason, had begun to warn, this fellowship of alcoholics is emotional dynamite. Its neurotic content can blow it to bits. When drinking, we were certainly explosive enough. Now that we were sober, would dry benders and emotional jags blow us up? When I think of explosions, I always think of my friend Icky. Down in Houston, Texas, they call him the Dynamite Man. Icky is an expert on explosives, on demolition. He was in the rear of the Russian retreat blowing up bridges during the war. After the war, he started to ply his trade again, and I guess he fell into the same error that a poor fellow in London did the other day. This alcoholic Londoner turned up before a magistrate. He had been picked up stiff drunk. His bottle was empty. The magistrate said, "Did you drink it all?" "Oh, yes." "Why did you drink it all?" "Because I lost the cork." Down there in Houston, it must have been one of those days when our friend Icky lost his cork. Icky was commissioned to blow up a certain pier in Houston Harbor, and he blew up the wrong one. The great question in the early days was this: would we blow up, or could we stay together? Today we have the answers. This anniversary meeting in St. Louis is a vast testament to the fact that we have held together. Pioneering in AA, of course, has not stopped. I hope it never will. We feel secure here today, but there are still places out on the AA front in distant lands where right now they are going through all the pains and trials of our early days. For example, The New York office recently received a letter written by a Jesuit priest in India. It told the story of a Hindu schoolteacher who owned a cow and a tiny plot of ground. His wife was stone deaf, and he had a sister who, like himself, drank like a fish. His salary as a teacher was about 50 cents a day. The Jesuit translated AA's 12 steps for him, and in spite of his poverty, in spite of his wife's deafness, in spite of his domineering and drunker sister, he was staying sober. We know that this lone Hindu is probably feeling just the same worries that Dr. Bob and I did back there in the living room in Akron. This Hindu pioneer is probably asking, can I hang together myself? Can I carry this message? Will I be able to form a group? Yes, he is asking those very questions. But he will soon be in communication with our world office, and we can send solid assurance to that distant outpost that we are with him, all of us, and that our experience is his to draw on. A footnote says, in 1984, there are 97 AA groups in India. Almost in the same mail, a letter came from a Presbyterian minister out on another AA front. He said, for a long time, I've been trying to get a group started here in Thailand. Recently, a highly educated Thai, speaking fluent English, came along. He was a terrible case of alcoholism, and he desperately wanted to get well. Now he has had a promising period of sobriety and is eager to translate the entire AA literature into Siamese. He and I are already at work starting groups. Can you give us a hand? The minister continued, we took AA's 12 steps over to the largest Buddhist monastery in this province. We showed them to the priest at the head of it. After he had finished looking over the 12 steps, the monk said, why, these are fine. Since we as Buddhists don't understand God just as you do, it might be slightly more acceptable if you inserted the word good in your steps instead of God. Nevertheless, you say in these steps that it is God as you understand him. That clears up the point for us. Yes, AA's 12 steps will certainly be accepted by the Buddhists around here. To some of us, the idea of substituting good for God in the 12 steps may seem like a watering down of AA's message. But here we must remember that AA's steps are suggestions only. A belief in them as they stand is not at all a requirement for membership among us. This liberty has made AA available to thousands who never would have tried at all had we insisted on the 12 steps just as written. But changes in them seldom last. The original version usually wins out. What has proved so true here in America will probably prove true in many a far-off land. Alcoholics may be led to believe in God, but none can be forced. Now, what does this all mean? It means that there are going to be AA groups in India and in Thailand and in many other faraway places where alcoholics dwell. They are going to be plagued by our early fears, but we can help them and reassure them. Speaking of fears, a story turned up at the office. It seems that AA had made a start in Tokyo. As usual, it began among the American drunks, but then it spread out to the Japanese. Soon there was quite a Japanese contingent, of which we heard very good reports. Then one day, a Japanese appeared at the New York office. He had heard that his fellows in the homeland now had AA groups and had begun to write to them to get the inside track. Now, in a state of great alarm, he said, awful things are going on over there in Japan. Did you know that they have two kinds of AAs over there? Of course, they have the 12 steps, just as we have them here, but there is now another AA leader who has written 10 steps, and they are charging 100 yen to attend his meetings. Once upon a time, that sort of heresy would have scared us to death. Today it is only amusing. We know that they will soon be infiltrated by common sense and experience. They will find that nobody can professionalize AA's 12th step, and the elder who means well and does badly will mend his ways. He will finally see that alcoholism is a quest for survival in which the good is sometimes the enemy of the best, and that only the best can bring the true good. Very much more could be told about AA out on its distant reaches, its pioneering fronts. For example, there is an AA night and day radio communication that passes from tankers on the Atlantic over to the Pacific. There is good old Captain Jack on a Standard Oil tanker plying the world ports. He leaves AA literature when he goes ashore, and he looks up bartenders, doctors, and preachers, asking them for prospects. An AA group just recently started in Florence, Italy, because an AA sailor came ashore and got a prospect from a bartender. Many a group starts in such an improbable and fantastic way. It has become almost literally true that where two or three of us are gathered together in his name, there a group will form. Let me tell you the wonderful legend about that AA group way up toward Point Barrow in Alaska. A couple of prospectors went out and got themselves a cabin and a case of scotch. The weather turned bitter, 50 below, and they got so drunk they let the fire go out. Barely escaping death by freezing, one of them woke up in time to rekindle the fire. He was prowling around outside for fuel, and he looked into an empty oil drum filled with frozen water. Down in the ice cake, he saw a reddish-yellow object. They thawed it out, and it turned out to be an AA book. One of the pair read the book and sobered up. The legend has it that he became the founder of one of our farthest north groups, perhaps the one in which we now have plenty of Eskimos. The last I heard about those Alaskan groups was that they were in communication by radio every day with the AA group that functions on the north end of the Greenland ice cap among the men at our air base there. Alcoholics Anonymous got started in Ireland in 1946 when Connor F., an AA tavern owner from Philadelphia, decided to go on a vacation with his wife to the Emerald Isle. When they got to Dublin, they both said, "Never mind the vacation. Let's start a group here." So they made their way to a local mental hospital, the one endowed by the author clergyman Swift, and there they found their first man, Richard P. And so AA began to take root in Ireland. The Dublin group, by the way, has achieved a special renown because of its world correspondent, Sackville M., the group's honorable secretary. When it comes to helping alcoholics by mail, he is no doubt the world's champion. The beginning of AA in England in early 1947 was a striking one. Some years ago, Bob B., a Canadian mining engineer, went to London, where he met up with Bill H., an alcoholic greengrocer. By correspondence with New York, two or three of the English were already struggling for sobriety. But the appearance of these two upon the scene soon resulted in an active AA group. As a result, London, and indeed all England, is today sprawling with groups. At first, however, they met such resistance in Britain that at one time only the Financial Chronicle would publish an advertisement about AA. All the other English papers were afraid that it was a fraud. The reverse process was seen when a Scottish nobleman, Philip, journeyed to America. He came over to have a look at the International Christian Leadership Movement, where he met with a group of businessmen who were interested in bringing God into industry through the medium of breakfast clubs for prayer and planning. Philip thought that maybe he could introduce the breakfast club idea to Scotland, and he hoped that such a good work would loosen his fatal attachment to the bottle. At the very first session, he met an old-time Philadelphia AA, George R., who gave him AA right off the spiritual main line. The head of one of Scotland's most ancient clans sobered up on the spot. He took AA back to his native heath. and soon alcoholic Scots were drying up all the way from Glasgow ship chandlers to society folks in Edinburgh. Canadian AA, too, is of the very best. Sometime in 1940, a temperance worker in Toronto showed the AA book to an alcoholic who had resisted all other attempts at rescue. Again, the AA book turned the trick, and together these two exposed many a Toronto problem drinker to the AA contagion, and the process of multiplication set in, which eventually carried AA to about every city and town in the province of Ontario. This good friend, George Little, a minister as well as a temperance worker, was not a little disappointed that his strange new flock showed no interest whatever in getting everybody bone dry. They insisted they were concerned only with local imbibers who wanted AA. Here it was definitely proved for the first time that AA could never become a dry crusade, a fact which has since puzzled many a worker in the dry cause. This first crossing of the border was followed in 1941 by another, when Windsor, Ontario, just across the river from Detroit, began to harbor Canada's Group Number 2. A footnote here says, though some meetings were held in 1941-42, start of Windsor Group dates from October 1943. In Vancouver, British Columbia, a non-alcoholic was also paired with an alcoholic from the very start. This time, it was a public-spirited candy manufacturer who passed the book on to Charlie B., a real estate broker. Inspired with a message and full of energy, this pair canvassed the city of Victoria and half the province in a hurry. And soon, BC's Alcoholics Anonymous was a reality. After a time, the message spread eastward over the prairies of Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba. Montreal, meanwhile, had begun to simmer. Dave B., the Montreal group's founder and a marathon 12-stepper, had sobered up on reading an AA book sent him by his sister. Here we saw AA's very first French members. I shall forever remember that early bilingual provincial meeting where I first heard the Lord's Prayer in French. In due course, solid AA began to flourish in Newfoundland and the Maritime Provinces. And, of course, it was only a question of time when Quebec City and Trois-Rivières, thus flanked on both sides, would have their own groups. The Quebec clergy, at first doubtful, are today among AA's most ardent well-wishers. So are many public officials. We can never forget the party that Montreal's Mayor Oud once threw for us. It was probably the first official reception that any AA group ever had. As we know, AA literature has a way of turning up in most surprising places. A broker of Johannesburg, South Africa, read an article in the Reader's Digest about us and sent to New York for a pamphlet, which so excited him that he fell like a buzzsaw on the derelict drunks of his city. He had a calling to scrape the bottom of the barrel. As an extra inducement, he offered his clients a certain amount of rehabilitation money. Naturally, he was flooded by swarms of eager aspirants, who it soon appeared were far more interested in handouts than they were in sobriety. Verging on complete wreck, this enterprise was saved by the timely arrival of another drinker, Val D., who had just obtained a copy of the AA book, one reading of which had struck him cold sober. Almost at the same time, another South African, a native of Perth, had sobered up through the book and had gone right to work on the alcoholics in his own town. Through the more orthodox methods of these two devotees of AA's big book, and with reinforcing letters from General Headquarters, things began to hum in South Africa. A whole volume could now be written about our progress down there, telling how AA has grown from these very fragile beginnings. In the latter part of 1942, we began to get our first letters from Australia, from S.J. Minogue, a psychiatrist associated with Rydalmere Mental Hospital in Sydney, and from a priest, Father Dunley, at the same institution. We furnish them with literature, including the AA book and a correspondence started with Dr. Minogue, which has lasted ever since. Month after month, the doctor and the priest labored with their grim cases and were aided by an attendant named Mr. Arch McKinnon. Letter after letter from Dr. Minogue reported no results at all. Indeed, it took over 2 years to produce anything like an AA group. These non-alcoholics had great difficulty in getting the proper identification with their patients, but late in 1944, they finally had success with two of them, Ben and Rex, the latter becoming Australia's first AA secretary. In March 1945, Rex wrote Bobby at the New York office in substance as follows. Dear Secretary, Dr. Minogue has handed over all of the correspondence to me, he being too fully occupied as superintendent at Rydalmere to answer it himself. It must not be thought, however, that the doctor's interest is flagging, for the contrary is the case. You will be pleased to know that a group has now been formed in Sydney. Our address is above. The movement here was started by Dr. Minogue, Father Dunley, and Mr. McKinnon, a hospital attendant. They are not alcoholics, but they have gathered around themselves 7 or 8 real ones, including myself, and we are netting new recruits every day. We feel that the movement is gathering momentum in Australia, so we now want a formal affiliation with Alcoholics Anonymous. Sincerely yours, Rex A., Secretary. The Aussies were indeed on their way. Australia now has its thousands of members in all walks of life, and on all sides they enjoy the warmest public blessing. The Australia development will certainly be remembered as a seldom-matched example of pioneering fortitude and faith. These glimpses of AA worldwide reveal the incredible distance that AA has come since that fall day in 1937 when Dr. Bob and I looked apprehensively toward the future. Then we had only the word-of-mouth program, the substance of the formula for sobriety that Ebby had given me. AA's 12 steps had not yet been written, and the AA book was scarcely an idea. Worldwide service and unity were only dreams. AA's first national development of consequence came in 1939. In September that year, Fulton Owsler, then editor of Liberty magazine, published a piece called Alcoholics and God, written by Morris Markey. About 800 frantic inquiries descended upon us immediately, and we wrote to them all. Then came Mr. Rockefeller's dinner in 1940. It was followed by another large number of letters pleading for help. But the really big flood came in March 1941, when Jack Alexander's feature article appeared in the Saturday Evening Post. A real Niagara then broke loose, and we were deluged with letters and with alcoholics by the thousands. This sudden growth ushered in a period of awful uncertainty. The big test of AA's unity began in earnest. We were operating with only the benefit of casual contacts, travelers going from one place to another, letters from the office, one pamphlet, and one book. Could we, on that slender basis, form ourselves into groups that could function and hang together? We simply did not know. Alcoholics in twos and threes were tough enough, but if they were gathered in much larger groups, what then? There had already been an ominous foretaste of the problems of mushrooming groups, quarrels over leadership, money, membership, clubs, exploitation of AA's name, panhandling, and even romancing. As the Saturday Evening Post crop of alcoholics tried to form themselves into hundreds of new groups, the specters of disunity and collapse grew to frightening proportions. We could only do our best and leave the rest to God. Just before the big test fell upon us, one of our New York members, named Ray W., went to San Francisco in 1940 to take a sales course. This was another one of those improbable beginnings. Ray had been an atheist, and he still stuck to it. Nevertheless, he had been sober a couple of years and was broad-minded enough to take the AA book to San Francisco with him. We handed him a list of inquiries from that area which had been contacted by mail only. When he got to San Francisco, Ray began calling up these people, and a few of them gathered at his hotel. He said to them, "Now, boys, this AA is great stuff. It really saved my life. But there's one feature of it I don't like. I mean this God business. So when you read this book, you can skip that part of it." 10 days later, Ray was on his way back east, leaving a shivering and divided group in his wake. But they soon found two wonderful friends, Mrs. Gordon Oram and Dr. Percy Poliak, a psychiatrist who had been impressed with AA as he had seen it at work in Bellevue Hospital in New York. Now, at the San Francisco County Hospital, Dr. Poliak gave the group his full support, and he continued it ever afterward. Mrs. Oram had a boarder, Ted, for whom she had already obtained the AA book. She opened her flat for the first AA meeting late in 1939, where salesman Ray's contacts foregathered with Ted. Ted never made the grade, but one John C. did, and he has stayed in the clear ever since. Soon these were joined by Fred and Amy C., and a little bit later by King, Ned, and others. At this stage, there was plenty of slipping and backsliding, but encouraged by Mrs. Oram and Dr. Poliak, the group somehow held together.